The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
There is a ticking time bomb looming over the American economy. Nearly $2 trillion in student loans owed by 50 million borrowers. And this is not just a problem for younger Americans. Those over 50 years old have the fastest growing student loan debt burden of any age group.
40% of Americans 65 and older are in default, and Washington will collect by garnishing the Social Security of seniors in default.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, I know a guy who is actually, gosh, what is he, 60 years old, give or take a year? This guy fell behind. He went to college, I guess, in the 80s or whatever it was. For some reason, I guess he said he's just bad with his money. He was unable to go ahead and to pay off his student loans. And never really earned a decent income. He had to raise a family, so they took a back seat. And they mushroomed. They grew, right? Got really big. He is still paying those loans to this day. He is still paying it to this day at 60 years of age. And I know a lot of people, it sounds like an anomaly, right? That's just one guy. There's another story or two. I know a young girl who's in a similar situation as well. This is debt that could be just crippling. You know, one of the issues still on the table is forgiving student loan debts. I know some of the progressives want complete student loan forgiveness. I tend to think the president's probably going to not just suspend repayments for a while, but I think right before the elections, this is just an educated guess, I think he's probably going to maybe announce $10,000 of forgiveness for people who have it. A lot of people are divided on it. Some people think it's not fair. I sacrificed. I paid my debts back. Why should they get $10,000? I didn't go to college. No, I get it. There's a lot to talk about. There was a piece in the Associated Press, and the federal government has issued a notice to student loan servicers not to start sending out billing statements yet. So you sit back and you think, well, what's that all about? It might indicate that something is coming down the line on forgiving those debts. How much? I don't know. Maybe it's a certain group of people. I don't know. But right now, as you heard in that piece that we just ran there, student debt is at an all-time high. Credit card debt is starting to climb as well. Last week, I heard a report that Americans carry something like $16 billion in credit card debt. I'm sure that number is going to continue to go up as inflation numbers stay high. People use their plastic. Right, you whip out your credit card when you know you don't have enough in your bank account, and people say, "I'll pay it when I get paid," and it doesn't seem to happen. They fill up their gas tank, they buy the food, they get the school supplies for their kids. The New York Federal Reserve recently reported that household debt has risen to $16 trillion. That's household debt. That's an increase of about $46 billion just over the last quarter. And gosh, CNN reported that not only balances are rising, but 233 million new credit card accounts were opened in the second quarter of the year. What does that say? 233 million new credit card accounts were opened in the second quarter of the year. We're a population of what, 320 million, somewhere in that range? Maybe a little less. I mean, that's pretty amazing. So with all that debt, there are people who are calling for an ancient practice, something called general debt amnesty. And I don't know if you're familiar with this. In ancient times, this kind of amnesty happened, especially when, let's say, a king conquered another king. But then the Mosaic Law came around, and the Lord commanded such an amnesty once every 7 years. And then there was supposed to be a year of jubilee once every 50 years when all debt was forgiven. Could something like that happen today? And I thought we could take a look. And not just at student loans and rising debt, but we could take a look at this spiritually as well. How do you deal with it? And how would a debt amnesty look? Dr. Jay Richards joins me today. He's the William E. Simon Senior Research Fellow at the Heritage Foundation. He's been a guest on the program many times, a very gifted writer, and it's always fun to talk with him. Oh, he's executive director, too, of The Stream. Check that out, thestream.org. He's a senior fellow of the Discovery Institute, but he's executive editor there. So if you haven't checked out that website yet, stream.org, I think you'll be glad you did. Doctor, welcome back. Good to talk with you again.
Hey, thanks, Drew. Yeah, this is a really interesting
topic, and it's weird because I actually wrote a little bit about this question when I wrote my book, Money, Greed, and God, though I didn't talk about student loans per se. I did talk about this idea of a Jubilee year. So it's an interesting mix of theology and economics, needless to say.
So money, greed, and God. I'm jotting that down right now because I do not have that. And that sounds like a great read and a great discussion. I'm always promoting eat, fast, feast, heal your body while feeding your soul, Christian Guide to Fasting. We've talked about that in the past. Money, greed, God. All right, well, let's talk about this. You know, I think, gosh, how likely would a debt amnesty be? How would forgiveness work? Maybe bring us back in time. What happened historically? Yeah. And if something like this was to happen, how would it be played out? I just think we're too complicated today to be able to do that. But go ahead. I mean, explain. Yeah. I'd love to learn.
Okay, so there's a bunch of kind of misconceptions. And so let's just focus on the Mosaic Law in particular. You got to think about ancient Israel. It's divided into tribes. It's entirely agrarian. So people's wealth was tied completely to the land, which God had divided up according to tribes. And so there was prescribed, as you mentioned, that really the key thing is this Jubilee year, which is supposed to happen 7 times 7 years, so every 49 years or so, when land that might have been, you know, borrowed or someone has sold off land to get rid of their debts, the land was supposed to go back to the original family. And now people will look at that and say, well, that's like debt forgiveness. It's just, it'd be exactly the same as if you sort of just had all your car debt or something forgiven. But that's really a misconception. You just got to think about the market here a little bit. If the entire country, you know, okay, any sale of land is going to go back to the seller on some particular year. So let's say we're 20 years out from the next Jubilee year, then every person that's lending or selling land is going to know that. So that's going to actually determine what the price is. And so if you had a national policy like this, what it would mean when you were selling land would be that you're really just you're leasing the land for some fixed amount of time based upon when it would have to revert to the owners. And so rather than anyone really ever being able to sell their land permanently, they would be leasing it for as long as they could until they had to revert. And so the price of the land would be determined that way. Just as you pay a lot less if you're, say, leasing a house for a year, you're not going to pay the whole price of the house than if you actually buy the house. And so that's why right away there's a disanalogy between this kind of Jubilee year that you'd have in a situation like that, where it's built into the lending system, the buying and the selling system, versus a loan that you get in which the deal, the contract, is that you're going to pay back the loan with some fixed amount of interest, which is the interest is really the price on the loan. And then all of a sudden have the federal government decide arbitrarily that the person you borrowed the money from isn't going to get the money back, which is what we would really be talking about in this case. And so first thing to realize is that if we want to apply one of these kind of ancient policies, we're going to need to make sure that it's really applying and not something completely different, which is actually what I think we're talking about if we were to talk about something like student loan forgiveness.
Yeah, so it was fascinating, the history behind it. I love that. Is it possible, could debt amnesty work in our current economy? Of course, we're not agricultural, you know, we're not all agrarian anymore. And, you know, there are people that have car loans and mortgages, student loan debt. I mean, you think about the amount of different type of debt that people have, and what would be fair? How would it be meted out? How likely would anything like that happen? And what would be needed? I know it's a lot of questions to get a government to say, you know what, we're going to do this. And would the fruit of it be good? Would it bring some relief and maybe help the economy? There's another one for you.
I mean, yeah, I'd say that's like 10 questions there, Drew. But yeah, so here's the kind of key thing. Would it be fair or just is the question. And so to really answer that, you got to be clear what we're talking about. If we just talk about debt amnesty or debt forgiveness, that sounds like a nice thing. Let's reframe it. Is it just for you to get money that you borrowed and agreed to pay back, and then someone else to be forced to pay it back instead of you, right? Now, if you frame it that way, it doesn't sound very just, does it? It actually sounds like the epitome of injustice. I benefited from the loan. I spent it, right? And then the lender, they're going to get paid. So the question is, the president's not saying all these private lenders that are part of the student loan system, they're just going to get bilked. He's not saying that. What would actually happen, let's assume the president had the legal authority to do this. So he just sort of declares that everyone has, you know, that has student loans, say up to $10,000 are going to be forgiven. What that means is that it goes on the federal budget sheet and it's going to be paid for. It immediately add to the deficit and so to the debt, and then it would be paid for in the form of higher taxes later. So in other words, other people that didn't get the loan would be paying for the loan that the student got. Well, that just seems to me to be fundamentally unfair. And that's why it's important to really realize what we're talking about. Now, the question of whether it would work or not, well, I guess it depends on what it's supposed to do. If it's supposed to improve the president's chances at the in election, right, or the Democrats' chances in the 2022 election, then from President Biden's perspective, it might work. If it's supposed to solve the problem of student debt, no, I don't think so. I think if anything, it would sort of distort the incentives for lending. But just in terms of being fair and just, I think it's seriously unjust simply because it changes the terms of the original agreement. And moreover, make someone else who was not party to the agreement, did not benefit from it, nevertheless have to pay for it. That's what we're talking about. There's no such thing as a free lunch. And if the person that borrowed the money doesn't pay it back, somebody else is going to pay it back instead.
Yep. My guest today, Dr. Jay Richards. If you want to join us, you want to sound off, you've got a question, a comment, maybe an idea, 888-914-9149. You can call now and get in. That's 888-914-9149. Student loan debt. There's a lot of controversy over that. Some think it's a really good way to give some people relief. It can be very crippling. It's rising because it's often connected to these rising interest rates. How do you feel about forgiving a portion of it? I know some of the progressives want $50,000. I think the president's more comfortable around $10,000. But there are people who think, hey, I never had a loan. Why should I pay somebody else's? Or I paid mine off. And yet this could be a form of relief for those who are crippled by it. How do you look at student loan relief?
Well, so any policy, of course, is going to help some people, right? So if somebody takes my stuff and gives it to someone else, presumably someone else is going to benefit from it. So if I have a burden of student loan, and it's taken off my, you know, balance sheet and given to someone else, it's going to help me. And so, of course, with policy, you want to say, okay, one, we can't do anything that's intrinsically unjust, and two, you don't want to make the situation worse. I think there are really straightforward terms to student loans, and people are responsible for that. But there's this wider question, Drew, and it's whether the student loan system itself makes sense. I mean, everyone knows that you can discharge your loan, say, on credit cards by declaring bankruptcy. In fact, bankruptcy law is the modern way that we solve this problem, which is that we don't want people to get so in debt that they can sort of never dig their way out of it, right? And so they not only can they not pay back their loans, but they just can't live life. That's what bankruptcy law is for. And so loans that are subject to bankruptcy, the interest rate's going to reflect that. So bank lends you something or credit card company lends you something. They know you might discharge it by bankruptcy. And so they calculate that into the risk. The reason student loans are not generally subject to that is because actually people, when you get a student loan, you're usually getting a below market rate price. So you're actually getting a discount on that. And the trade-off is that it's almost impossible to discharge it in regular bankruptcy proceedings. And so the question is whether that system really makes sense. I mean, any economist will tell you that if you flood a zone with cheap money, you're going to increase the price of the good. And so the irony is that the student loan system was set up to help poor people, poor students, be able to go to college, but the immediate effect of it was to vastly increase the price of college. So it's not even obvious to me that it actually originally solved its original problem. I also think schools kind of get off scot-free. So schools will often, they'll accept a student. They know perfectly well the student's not she's taking gender studies as her major. Mm-hmm. She's unlikely to be able to pay back $80,000. They benefit from it. The student has that. I honestly think a really good reform of the system would be to make the schools partially liable for the loan, because I think that would actually help them to police it. They'd pay more attention to, okay, look, is this student going to be able to pay this back with the basket weaving major? They'd have to make decisions differently. I think that's really where we need to be focusing our attention, and not on getting other people to pay loans that somebody else has borrowed.
Hey, I'm with you about reform. I mean, it's just so easy to get those student loans, and a kid who's 17 years old going to college, 18 years old,
mm-hmm.
doesn't understand the complexity of
yeah.
how long it's going to take to pay off 50, 70,000, whatever it is that he's going to ultimately have or more. Some educations
yeah.
are six figures. So, yeah, and you're right. Some of these degrees they have, the kids aren't mature. I can't tell you how many people I know who've graduated and they're not even in the field in which they graduated from. So to not make the money so easily available, but have some skin in the game with these universities as well, you know, I think that would be a big game changer. And also the cost of education just skyrocketed. It's gotten out of control. As money became easier, I think the institutions took advantage of that, you know, and they became more and more expensive. So it was a vicious snowball. It just kept getting bigger. We'll take a few calls. If you want to join us, 888-914-9149. Let's go to Wisconsin. Jim, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Am I on?
Yeah, you are on, sir. Go right ahead.
Oh, okay. I was just calling and you're talking about the student loans and all that stuff. What if, is that tied to our gross national product? Do we use the student loan money to pay our debt?
Thank you, Jim.
That's the first thing I want to ask.
All right, doctor, you want to respond?
No. And so, yeah, so the loans, it's a complicated system in which you got private banks and actually kind of semi-public private banks that actually lend the money. And then it's, in theory, it's paid back with interest. And so it's not on the government balance sheet because it's a reasonably functioning market. It's just like you wouldn't see the home loans or something that go between private parties and banks. That's not going to be on the federal balance sheet. Now, if the president sort of declares by fiat that, let's say it's $100 billion of loans are going to be forgiven, that would immediately go on the deficit for that year, and then it would be a part of our debt. So every dollar that's, quote, forgiven, what that really means is that the federal government is going to pay the loan rather than the person that received it. Because remember, the money's already been spent, and so it's not like it can disappear. That debt is just going to go somewhere, and rather than it being the student that borrowed it or the bank, they're not going to stick the banks with it because it would destroy them. It goes on the federal balance sheet to be paid for by taxpayers. So that's how it would work.
Got it. Jim, thank you. Hey, if you are struggling with your student loans, we'd love to hear your story too. I mean, how have student loans impacted you, and what are your thoughts on maybe having some relief either come your way or to others who've dealt with it? Dee Dee's listening in Phoenix, Arizona. Dee Dee, good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
Doctor.
Yes.
Brilliant idea. And the reason I say that is because it's a win-win situation. Everybody benefits from it. The student, their family, the community. And my only caveat would be, doctor, is I think in terms of their prerequisites, they need to sign up for a class on ethics. Ethics tells you the benefit, the blessing they're going to get from this, mm-hmm. and it guides them to making a contribution to this society. What do you think?
Well, I certainly do think that it would help if students understood the ethical dimensions of borrowing money and paying it back. Yeah, that would certainly be nice. Honestly, I wish that politicians knew that too. I wish they were forced to do that, quite frankly. But you know what you're dealing with here is a kind of complicated moral quandary. And whatever the kind of benefits of a policy might be, the first question we ought to always ask is this choice intrinsically good or evil, right? So we don't, something that might be beneficial to 100 people, but it involves us murdering someone, right? Well, in that case, we're not going to do this utilitarian calculation and say, well, it's better overall. On the other hand, I think there are multiple ways in which we could sort of reform the student loan system to just actually make the incentives line up better. And so that's why I think, look, if you're borrowing money and you're an adult, you do have some responsibility for looking at to the terms of it. At the same time, I think the colleges and universities are the ones that are getting off the best on this because they never end up having to bear the burden of the loan. And so their incentives aren't aligned properly. And I think that's honestly the thing that would be by far the most just. It would bring the price of college down and bring the loans down, and it'd give them some skin in the game. I honestly think that's the thing that makes this market so distorted compared to, say, car loans.
Yeah, my guest today, Dr. Jay Richards. We'll go back to the phones in a second. If you want to join us, 888-914-9149. I love the idea, though, and I don't know whether this happens when you get the loan, but I think whether you're in grade school or high school or whatever age, probably high school, you know, before you get to college, there should be courses on how to manage your finance, to understand mm-hmm. how debt works, the how compounding works, right? Understanding yeah. interest. I mean, there's all these different things that you should know before you take on a loan, or what you need to do right. as you move forward. And I think kids would be so far better off. I know if I had those principles when I was, 17 or 16, if I understood those going into my 20s, I started my own business when I was a young guy, and I had money come into it, I had lots of it. I didn't know how to handle it. I didn't know what to do. I mean, I was not schooled and not trained in that. So I think that's a really, really good point. I think that's it. I do think we should bring the cost of education down and have these universities take a little culpability. Doctor, on another note here, you're a professor, so this is kind of not a fair question mm-hmm. to ask you, but is college education worth it today? I mean, I see so many people get into debt. Yeah. And they take those, right. Home weaving 101 classes or whatever it is you say, they're learning about gender studies. They get out with degrees they really can't use. And now they're in debt and they saddle their family. They put off having kids. They don't buy homes. I mean, there's a ripple effect to this. Your thoughts on higher education?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that all things being equal, a college degree can be great, both for the soul and it can also help the bottom line. But it can also be exactly the opposite. It can be a massive waste of time. It can pollute your soul and your mind, and it can cost you a lot of money. And so that's just the reality of the situation. I absolutely do not think that an expensive college education makes sense for everyone. It probably makes sense, frankly, for a third or even less of the population. I think there's a large percentage of the population that would have a better life, both spiritually and personally and financially, if they developed a skilled trade. I don't see there's any reason that we should be giving these kind of preferential treatment to college degrees over apprenticeships or skilled trades. And that's part of the distorting effect of this, is that a bunch of people that would have been better off not going to college end up going to college because of the loan program, going into debt for something that they would have been better off not to have had in the first place.
It's so true. My attitude has changed. I had five kids. I had four of them mm-hmm. in high school at the same time. So that meant four were in college mm-hmm. at the same time. I mean, it was a tough time for the Marianis. There's a lot of school. I had five, and they were all about a year apart practically. I'm from the generation, or at least my mindset is, the more you know, the better off you are. Higher education's important. You need to have your college degree. Mm-hmm. And I really stressed that to the kids and made sure they all, have a college education. But in retrospect now, my sister and brother-in-law, they did something a little bit different. My kids all wanted to go off to this university or that university, and they did. My brother-in-law and my sister, they made their kids spend 2 years in a local community college. So they went in, they matured, they got their A's, they weren't in debt. And then I think my sister Alicia and her brother, her husband, my brother-in-law, they ended up, I think, paying the last 2 years for their education. But even if they didn't do that and the kids had a fun the last two, that's much more digestible. Even if you realize, well, this isn't the career I wanted, this history degree is not going to really apply, or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. But at least you've got your degree. I think we undervalue community colleges today in that education. What are your thoughts on that?
I totally agree. I think for some reason there used to be kind of a stigma attached to that. I do think that college has gotten so expensive that lots of people, including lots of kind of upper middle class people, realize actually that's the way to go, especially if you're going to send a child to a really expensive private school. Yeah. Why not have them take their basic math and basic composition and some of these more mechanical kind of things. Yeah, do that. I mean, now look, having said all that, I do think there are some amazing Catholic liberal arts schools. My daughter was in the honors program at Catholic U and had a great time. My younger daughter is at the University of Dallas doing philosophy and English. Yeah, I mean, it's an amazing experience. It's enriching her soul. But we realize that, right? That, okay, this is going to kind of prepare her for life. It'll maybe help her get a job. It's going to enrich her soul. But we took all of that into account. We're able to do it. And so we did. But I do not think that would have made sense for every kid. And for a lot of us, especially those of us that are sort of from this background, it can be a tough pill to swallow if your child says, no, actually, I want to go become an electrician, or I want to go learn how to install Windows, when in fact, look, you can glorify God and have a fulfilling life doing that. And I think part of this is just a little bit of snobbiness that we need to get over.
It's true. There's a pride factor in a lot of this. And by the way, your daughter's going to the University of Dallas. I had breakfast about a month or two ago with the university president. He was up in the here at the network.
That's great.
And I didn't know a whole lot about the University of Delaware. It's actually a really good Catholic institution. I was super impressed when I got done talking to them. And, of course, Catholic University of America is there as well. So, hey, yep. Doctor, I know we got to leave it. I'd love to have you back at some point in time to talk about your other book, Money, Greed, and God. I'm going to make a note of that. I'd love to have a discussion on that. And if people want to follow you or get plugged in, I know the stream is a good source, but what's the best way to follow you or to connect?
Yeah, the quickest way actually is to follow me on Twitter at Dr. J. Richards, and then they can check out my most recent articles just by going to heritage.org.
Okay, that's at Dr. Is that D-R or D-O-C-T-O-R?
It's D-R, D-R J. Richards.
All right, check him out. Follow him on Twitter. You will be glad you did. We'll catch up again soon. Thank you for making time for us. It's always good to talk with you.
Thanks, Drew.
That's Dr. J. Richards. Stay with me. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit more. I want to get into another issue. Speaking of debt, right? How about the IRS? We know that billions of dollars are going to go their way right now. Are Americans correct to be terrified of an expanded IRS? And did you hear about your IRS auditor maybe having a machine gun? What do you hear this? You know, we receive over a million prayer requests every year, thanks in part to the Catholic Order of Foresters Studio Line, helping us stay connected to your intentions. Learn how our sponsor can support your family with life insurance at relevantradio.com/Forester. An Illinois Life Insurance Society, not available in all states.
From the Golden Gate Bridge to the Brooklyn Bridge, Drew Mariani is on your radio now. Your life connected coast to coast on Relevant Radio.
It'd be kind of cool if there was a bridge to Maui as well. That'd be one long bridge, though. Heard from Maui to Maine as well. Really all over the world. It's so good to be able to hang out with you. If you are new to the program, set it to the radio you're listening to, the station you're listening to, or if you got friends who you think should get connected. And I know we have listeners from South Africa to various parts of Asia to Europe. Get them plugged in as well, around the country and around the world. Always a great conversation here. I want to look at another issue here. We just talked about debt forgiveness, debt amnesty, student loans. There's a lot going on. Gosh, I don't know what the future holds, but, you know, if you have a small business, you're probably going to end up getting audited in the not-too-distant future. I think audits are going to be on the rise. Now, of course, you know, this might be off several years, and it may not happen. Maybe I'm wrong on this. You know, while the president's not talking about student loan forgiveness, Congress is passing a law that just increased the budget to, well, the Senate did, but they're going to be on board with this. They're going to increase the budget for the IRS. Was it 7 times, 14 times over what it is today? Some ridiculous amount. The idea that they have is that you need to spend money in order to make money, right? So they want to spend money on more auditors and enforcement agents in order to rake into the money that they're now handing out, presumably to cover the gap between our spending and our revenues. And they're going to be spending a lot of money because they want to hire 87,000 new agents. That's an army of IRS agents, if you think about that. That's more than, you know, many of the other areas of our government. So 87,000 new agents, what they're going to be doing, I'm not quite sure, but I bet they're going to be taking a look, you know, at some red flags. Did you give a little too much to that particular charity? You know, can you back it up? Do you have a small business? What about some of the deductions you're claiming? Right now, there's a backlog. Just to give you a perspective on where we are, of millions of paper tax returns. And you know, that issue doesn't seem to be getting addressed right now in this piece of legislation. Instead, the new agents are supposed to be conducting audits, presumably on corporations, of those making more than $400,000 a year. So you're probably safe, right? You're like, oh, I make under 400K, so they're going to go after the fat cats, right? Well, the indication is that's not really going to be the case. The middle class, those making under 400K, are probably going to feel the brunt of these new IRS audits and hires. What doesn't help matters is when you learn that the federal agencies whose existence basically is to push paper around, they've been found to be buying huge amounts of weapons and ammunition. And I don't know why they're doing this. We'll talk about that coming up here in just a second. Just to give you some perspective, the IRS, they bought about 5 million rounds of ammo. 5 million. I mean, right now, I think we have more than 200 federal agents who are armed and have arrest powers. And that's actually more than there are actually Marines. Marines only have, I think, 182,000 troops. So let's talk about it. Let's talk about, you know, the perspective of all this, what might take place in the not-too-distant future, how it's going to impact you. I'm joined today by Peter St. Ange. He is a research fellow in the Thomas A. Rowe Institute for Economic Policy Studies at the Heritage Foundation, and it's good to have him here with us today. Peter, thank you for your time. I'm looking forward to getting some perspective on what all this means.
Definitely. Thank you for having me on.
So, you know, we're hiring. No, go ahead, please.
Well, I was going to say previous guest, it sounds like you've discussed some of the waste, some of the things that the federal government is spending money on. And so, of course, this is the other half of it, which is, you know, they're handing out money to their friends, to their, you know, there's this crony bill that just came out, the so-called Inflation Reduction Act. To, you know, deadbeat borrowers, and that's going to be paid by the middle class and especially by small businesses now.
So explain that. They basically say, hey, don't worry. If you make under 400,000, we're going after the billionaires. You know, we're going to make sure people pay their fair share. I've heard people say, if you're not cheating, if you're not doing anything wrong, you have nothing to worry about. How will this trickle down and target middle-income Americans, and how do you respond to that you know, whole honesty factor? There's a lot of people who are honest, but they make mistakes or they do something that sends up a red flag that may cause them an audit, even though, you know, they're not really doing anything wrong.
That's exactly right. Most of the disputes with the IRS are based on errors. A lot of the bills that come out of Congress are poorly written. They overlap. It's not always clear exactly what you owe. And so, you know, what tends to happen is when you have a big company, well, they've got lawyers and accountants who, you know, sit there and negotiate this stuff out. Good enough for a small business. That's expensive. It's intimidating. It's scary for people, right? They could potentially lose their house. And so they'll just tend to settle, right? So the IRS comes in and says, we think you owe this much. And for most people, they'll just pay it. They just want to get out of trouble.
Yeah, it's a scary thing getting a call from the IRS or a letter saying, hey, we need to look into this. I mean, it's and it can be very, very costly, that's for sure. You know, if... go ahead.
No, sorry, I was going to say, today, you know, most audits that are happening today, right, these are not billionaires, these are not big companies. The majority of audits are already on middle-class people, making under 75,000, okay, and 80% of audits are on people making under 200,000. So that's still solid middle class. That is not 400,000 territory, right, as Biden kept promising. So this army of IRS agents, you know, if we take the way the agency is currently structured, they're going to be targeting the middle class above all.
Now, that's the frightening part. On another note, I mean, just hiring in the country right now, there are millions of job openings, right, available in the U.S. I think 11 million people who are unemployed. Where does the IRS think they're going to get 87,000 new agents? I mean, are they out there? Is it maybe very possible? And will they be qualified to do what they're hired to do? How good will they be?
Yeah, well, government workers, you know, they generally outbid the private sector. They're very well paid. Apparently, you know, if there's a nationwide lockdown, they still get paid. They can stay home, but they still get paid. So, right, the issue here, as you know, so often with government, is that they'll get their workers by taking them away from the rest of us. So, you know, again, if you're a small business, The biggest, by far the biggest challenge for small businesses right now is that they can't find employees.
Mm-hmm.
And so, of course, that's when, you know, you want to come in and hire an army of accountants. So on top of the fact that their job is going to be attacking largely those small businesses, they pull all that staff away from us in the middle of this, you know, really historic labor crisis.
Yeah, it's crazy. You know, on another note, people have commented that the raid on Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago residence in Florida, something, it's a preview of what will happen when you get 87,000 new IRS agents. You know, some are feeling that certain parties or people in power are using they're weaponizing certain agencies to kind of get what they want or to make it uncomfortable on certain people. Do you think I want to be fair, you know, maybe this won't be the case at all, but do you think maybe the IRS, that agency, can be used in a fashion like that? I mean, how insulated is it, and how safe are our citizens?
Oh, I think without a doubt it can be used that way. You know, we've seen a number of issues with the FBI, of course, over the past couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
The IRS has, you know, during Obama, there were issues where the IRS was giving additional scrutiny to people who were starting, you know, sort of right-leaning nonprofits. You know, if we go back to the 60s and 70s, it was absolutely common practice for presidents to harass taxpayers who were on the other side of the fence. And, you know, that's a concern, I think, really, over the past 2 years. We've seen a lot of that where it feels as if certain government agencies are giving, you know, it's just Christmas every day for certain groups who might vote on their side, but then on the other side of the aisle, it's just nonstop harassment and attacks.
Yeah, that's for sure. If you want to join us, the number here is 888-914-9149. Just taking a look at this massive wealth, health, and tax spending bill that has just come out from the Senate, more than likely will pass in the House. And what it means to you, in particular, if you're a medium-sized business, you earn less than $400,000, are you in greater danger now of being audited? And another note here, too, there's so much to talk about when it comes to the IRS. There was a representative in Florida who said that the IRS had about 5 million rounds of ammunition. They had 15 machine guns, along with a lot more weaponry. And I'm thinking, well, I can understand maybe having some weapons, but a number of other federal agencies, like even NOAA, of course, they have arms. But why does the IRS need to have machine guns and 5 million rounds of ammo? I don't quite understand the purpose of that.
Yeah, probably the most innocent spin you could put on it is that what government agencies do for a living is try to get bigger. That's their purpose in life. Like cancer, they just want to grow. They chase budget, and so they are constantly inventing new challenges, new crises we all face, or new threats directly to their agencies. So they sort of conjure up these bugbears and these, you know, you know, scary things that live in the closet so that they can justify budget increases. And that's been, you know, kind of a golden ticket since the Patriot Act, certainly, to getting extra money, is to get into the, you know, some angle of the law enforcement / security world. So I think that's probably the most innocent interpretation, is that this is a money grab. Hopefully it's not something more than that.
That makes sense. You know, the argument has been made that the IRS will go after, you know, of course, more middle class people because they can't hire lawyers and are willing to settle out a lot faster, making it cheaper to get money out of them. Do you see that happening? I mean, I don't want to always, I don't want to look for the negative in everything. I mean, maybe this is good. Maybe there are people who are cheating. Maybe there are people, you know, that need to be caught. I don't know. How do you see this playing out? And how will this resonate, too, just in terms of the elections? We have midterms coming up, and the generals are voters, whether they're red or blue, are they happy with this?
Yeah, well, there are pretty clear ways to reduce tax evasion, which is to get rid of any taxes that are frequently evaded. That's never on the horizon here. You know, if small businesses are not paying their sales tax, okay, get rid of the sales tax. right?
Right, exactly. But
that's not what they're talking about here, of course, right? Here, what they're talking about is essentially using the small percent of genuine tax evaders and then trying to paint the entire community with that. And, you know, when it comes to small business, I mean, again, right, over the past 2 years, we've really seen almost a war on small business, right? So during COVID, we had the discriminatory lockdowns, right, where small businesses had to shut down, but Walmart could stay open. Regulations overall, you know, regulation is a booming industry. It's largely what's growing the federal government. Regulations are typically, it's big companies that ask for them. And because they know that those regulations are much harder for the small business, right? If you go to many small towns in America, you know, 50 years ago, there were a lot of mom and pop restaurants, little stores, things like this. Today, it's down to a Burger King, a Walmart, and a gas station. So why is that? Because these new burdens they put on, right? For a big business, they've got, you know, a team of lawyers and accountants. They handle it no problem. Burger King probably has 1,000 lawyers at headquarters.
Wow.
On the other hand, for a mom and pop, they can't handle it. They get pushed out. And so these audits pile right on top of that kind of thing, where the big guys can handle it. The small guys, they end up folding.
I hope it's not the case. But I know the president promised this when he was on the campaign trail. And it looks like it will be a reality. Final thought here is I have to wrap this up here. How long will this take? I mean, you need to hire 87,000 people. The bill still has to pass. Are we looking at next year, 2 years, 5 years? How far off is this before people should begin to worry?
That's the question. Thankfully, the government is inefficient, so things do take time. So, you know, we're probably not looking at any major shift in the next year or two. But over the 3 to 5 year horizon, they will most likely beef up their staff and start going after people.
Well, thank you for making time for us today. I do appreciate it, Peter. So good to talk with you. I'd love to do it again. We'll continue to follow this story, but I'm grateful for your time today. Have a great one, okay?
Absolutely. Thank you.
You got it. It's Peter St. Ange. He is a research fellow in the Thomas A. Rowe Institute for Economic Policy Studies at the Heritage Foundation. If you want to read up on this, go to heritage.org, okay? Heritage.org. Great resource. They do phenomenal writing on a wide spectrum of different issues. All right, I need to take a very short pause. Stay with me. I'll be back on the other side.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the relevant radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
For tuning in, allowing me to be part of your afternoon. It is such a delight to hang out with you. Before we wrap it up, I want to share with you something that happened on this day in history. But also grab a pen and paper. If you have about 20 minutes, believe it or not, that's enough time to make a will. And Relevant Radio has partnered with this organization. Last year, I think it was the first time they did it. It's called Free Will. And they make creating a will easy and free. So make your will today. Just go to relevantradio.com/free will. It's relevantradio.com/free will. I don't know whether or not you have a will. If you don't, that might be a game changer for you. Check it out. Today is the anniversary, of course, of the bombing of Nagasaki, right? A couple really incredible events happened. I don't know if you know this or not, but there were two churches. And I often think about the protection of God. When we look at what's happening in the culture, whether it's economically or, you know, with droughts or, you know, climate change or threats of war, whatever it might be, plague, disease, new viruses, people get pretty stressed, pretty freaked out. And I want you to know that God's in control of everything, right? He is in total control, and he can protect even in the midst of a plague or even in the midst of a war, even in the midst of an atomic bomb. If you go back to 1945, on August 6th, that was the liturgical feast, believe it or not, of the Transfiguration of Christ. We just celebrated that this past Sunday, right? On that date, the transfigured face of God reflected in his children. It was disfigured with what was just a devastating explosion. There was an atomic bomb on that day over Hiroshima. and we remember what happened. It exterminated, vaporized, ended 140,000 men, women, and children. Horrific. I really wish America never dropped that bomb. Many people would argue on the point as to whether or not it ended the war and whether or not we had to. And there's a lot of people with that mindset, and I understand that. But even in the midst of great evil, of war, you see in the concentration camps of Auschwitz, today we celebrate also the anniversary of St. Teresa Benedicta of the Cross, Edith Stein, and Maximilian Kolbe. It was in Auschwitz as well. So many. God can bring good. And the same thing happened during these bomb blasts. There were miracles among the destruction. Yeah, at a distance of only 80 blocks from Ground Zero, right? When that explosion went off, there was a church where eight Jesuit missionary priests were praying. They were practically at Ground Zero, right? Ground Zero. And they survived. Unlike the buildings, which were three times farther away from where they were, which were completely destroyed. And these Jesuits went down in history as the Hiroshima 8. They didn't survive the explosion that instantly killed 86,000 people. They didn't just survive that to the amazement of scientists. They didn't survive the eradication that took place over that eight-block radius. But they lived into old age. They never were affected by radiation. And many people died in Japan from that. The following months and year, they were studied. They had, I think, something like 200 tests they underwent in the years of follow-up. People were like, what the heck happened? How did you guys survive an atomic bomb and not suffer the fallout from it, even if you survived the blast? One of the eight was a priest. His name was Father Hubert Schiffer. He was 30 years old on that day in August. He had celebrated Mass for the Feast of the Transfiguration, just sat down. He was ready to eat breakfast. And in his own very soft words, if you ever have a chance to hear him, he did an interview. He talked about what happened. He said, suddenly there was a terrific explosion. And it just filled the air with one bursting thunderstroke. He says, an invisible force lifted me from my chair. It hurled me through the air. It shook me. It battered me. It whirled me around and around like a leaf in an August wind and threw him to the ground. When he was asked, gosh, how did you survive? What happened? He says, I believe that I survived, that my fellow priests survived, because we were living the message of Fatima. This is 1945, right? A lady came in 17, and she asked everyone to pray the rosary, to pray it daily in the home. It would help defeat communism. It would help avoid wars. And even though the world didn't respond, we saw the rise of the Second World War, here was the culmination of it, right? This is a critical moment. The rosary brought divine protection to these priests. There was another miracle that took place on this day in Nagasaki. There was a Franciscan convent, the Japanese capital, if you will, of Catholicism. And on August 9th of the same year, just a couple days later, another atomic bomb, as I know, was dropped on Nagasaki. The city known as the Japanese capital of Catholicism. Two-thirds of Japan's Catholics live there. It's kind of a sad story. Nagasaki, like Hiroshima, was devastated, right? The Franciscan convent built by St. Maximilian Kolbe somehow, some way survived, right? Somehow, some way survived. And I'm thinking, well, and you may not know the story, Maximilian Kolbe was martyred in the concentration camps of Auschwitz. During that same war, he laid his life down for another man who was due to be killed, and Kolbe took his place. So Kolbe, prior to this, was a great evangelizer, and he decided to build a convent in a location that a lot of people, when he went to Japan, thought was really a poor idea. They just thought it was poorly chosen. It was near the center of the city, and despite the criticism, Kolbe insisted on the plot of land located behind a mountain. And nobody understood why he did this. I think God told him where to have this built. And it was that mountain, in fact, that protected the convent when that atomic bomb went off and destroyed the city, killing another 70,000 people. But in the midst of that death and that total destruction, God apparently, at least, I think in part due to Our Lady's intercession, protected those missionaries. Right? They lived so they could minister to the injured, to the sick, to the dying. They lived so they could witness to the world the horrors of this type of weaponry, of war. And above all, they witnessed to God's power and to his mercy. They witnessed the importance of the power of prayer and the protection that it brings. As I reflect on these two significant dates, August 6th and today, the anniversary of the bombing of Nagasaki, and it was after this we know that Japan surrendered, we have to pray. And I invite you to pray the Chaplet of Divine Mercy every afternoon with me at 3, every evening at 7 with Father Rocky. Just pray it yourself. You don't have to join us. Pray, pray, pray. Ask God for his mercy. Ask God for protection over our country from degeneration, from disaster, from disease, from war. Your prayers will have a greater impact than any politician, any legislator, any military could ever have. Believe me, your prayers go to the heart of God. They animate new life. They bring about change. They offer protection. They allow miracles to take place. Take a look at those 8 Jesuits at Ground Zero who, praying the rosary, survived what should have been absolute and imminent death. They were now living witnesses to the power of prayer and the protection that it brings. I am out of time for the day. Thanks for letting me spend a little bit of my day with you. I'll be back again tomorrow. Until then.